At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
You're watching a Highwire Media podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the True Crime Never Sleeps show. I'm your host as always, Larry Elise. And tonight, we continue our series Shit Out of Luck, which we air each the last Friday of every other month. And the other months, we do a series called Let's Talk, where we dive into a variety of true crime topics, both like legal issues and others. You can check out those videos out on my channel. And of course, give us your thoughts on this case in the comment section below. And with that, let's dive into today's episode of The Raincoat Killer. What motivates a serial killer? Is it their upbringing, or is it a product of their environment? Or are some people just seemingly born evil? This is a question that has plagued criminal profilers for ages. It's nearly impossible to pin down because oftentimes it's an unfortunate combination of events that lead to someone feeling resentment and jealousy. It's a troubled person's misguided attempt at revenge for perceived wrongdoings that eventually lead to a young man in South Korea to become the Raincoat Killer. Yoo Young Chul grew up in South Korea to a wealthy religious household. Due to his own feelings of dejection, he would develop resentment for the rich. Prior to his killing spree, Yoo racked up 14 charges on his records since graduating high school, primarily robbery and rape. In 1992, he married and had one son with his partner. However, she left him while he was serving time in prison for a convicted rape. Yoo was a self-identified smart person and claimed to have an IQ of 140. He was also known to fake having physical conditions to gain sympathy from authorities. For example, when arrested on a rape charge in 2002, he faked having an epileptic fit. Upon release from his 2002 arrest in 2003, Yoo reportedly purchased weapons and practiced for future crimes. Between September 2003 and July 2004, Yoo killed 20 or more people, typically by bludgeoning them with a hammer and then stabbing them. His targets included the wealthy, often elderly, and women who worked in massage parlors as sex workers. When the police were first trying to solve these murders, the crimes looked like robberies turned homicides. But they soon noticed that no money or items had been taken from the residences. Yoo himself claimed to have killed 26 people and reported he had even eaten some of their internal organs to cleanse the spirit. However, authorities have only been able to officially find him guilty for 20 murders and have been unable to prove or disprove his cannibalism claim. On September 24th, 2003, Yoo murdered an elderly couple who were once professors in Sinsadong, Seoul. Yoo admitted to bludgeoning them to death with a hammer. At the time of the murders, this region of Seoul was one of the most wealthy. While the scene was being investigated for evidence, a faint shoe print was found. On October 9th, 2003, Yoo broke into another Seoul home and killed three family members of the Ko family using a hammer. Ko Jung Won came home to discover his dead family members and called the police. His mother was found closest to the front door in the hallway. His wife was found in the kitchen. His son was found at the top of the stairs. Due to no leads and the lack of evidence of the family fighting back, police considered Ko and the people around him as a potential suspect. Gangnam police were spotted lurking around the scene due to similarities of the murder in Sinsadong. Police were able to gather two faint footprints at the scene. On October 16th, 2003, Yoo dragged an elderly woman into her bathroom and violently attacked her in Samsung-dong, Seoul. During the crime scene investigation, an additional faint footprint was found on the air conditioning unit outside of her home. It matched the footprint gathered at the previous crime scene in Gujidong. Investigators determined the same kind of wounds and attacks were present at these first three attacks, and they were able to begin developing a pattern in a theory that this was a repeat offender. On November 18th, 2003, Yoo broke into a detached Seoul home in, apologies for butchering these cities, communities wrong, in Haewadong and murdered Mr. Kim, the 87-year-old homeowner, and Bae, the 50-year-old housekeeper, via stabbing. After the attack, Yu set a fire to the home to try and destroy any evidence. This attack was different. Yu set a fire and police saw evidence of the family safe being tampered with. Police assumed it was a robbery homicide that ended in arson. However, they were able to identify another footprint at this crime scene and it matched the other two collected footprints. They used this evidence to also link these murders with the first three crime scenes. A one-year-old boy survived and was rescued, and for a while, similar murder reports ceased. That is, until December 2004. Over the course of about 4 months, Yu separately called 11 different sex workers and masseuses from the red light districts to come to his new studio apartment in Western Seoul. This was under the guise of being a typical financial and sexual exchange. But once the women were ready to leave, Yu would then murder them. This was a major shift in his modus operandi. Rather than breaking into a victim's home, he was luring his victims away from the safety of the public. After killing them by attacking their heads with his hammer, Yu entirely dismembered these victims' bodies and hung their decapitated heads from their tied-up hair on his toilet paper holder. Yu intentionally removed these victims' fingerprints to help keep them from being identified. He eventually disposed of their limbs, stored in plastic bags in the mountains around Seoul. He would take these bodies to their final locations in cabs, throwing kimchi in the bag with the bodies to cover the smell and have something to blame it on. Yu individually marked the locations where he had buried his victims, making sure he never accidentally dug up an old site. Yu's murders began happening in quicker and quicker succession as time went on. Prior to this case, police departments from different districts did not often spread the word about any unsolved cases. Unsolved cases led to poor reviews and less chance of a promotion through the promotion system used at the time. Despite this, after the second murders, police from the first crime scene showed up once rumors had spread that there were similarities between them. At the second crime scene in Gujidong, Seoul, Korea's first ever criminal profiler, Kwon Il-yong, was brought to the initial crime scene investigation. At first, he tried to focus on reported crimes of the previous 30 years, trying to find a similar perpetrator or crime. He was particularly stumped by the weapon used, and the forensics team struggled to recreate the types of injuries in their labs. Later on, they discovered this was because Yu actually crafted his own unique weapon. Kwon assessed that the intense head injuries probably meant this was a crime fueled by someone with intense anger and resentment, rather than a typical robbery, especially since the money and valuables were left untouched. At the third crime scene, Kwon and the forensics team were able to determine that the footprints collected at the second and third crime scenes were a match, and the victims' wounds at all three crime scenes were similar and likely resulted from the same attacker. At this point, the Seoul Police Department wanted to deny the claim that there may be a serial killer for fear that the public may panic, but news outlets were already reporting it as fact. Since the fourth crime scene in Hwaeyadong was so different, investigators didn't connect it to the first three initially. This was the first of Yu's crimes where arson was used, and police found evidence that the attacker tried to break into the family safe. However, a matching footprint and similar wound were found. The forensics team analyzed the footprints and determined they were left by a buffalo shoe. They also were able to spot Yu on CCTV footage nearby the location of the fourth crime scene. It only captured Yu's back, but the family noted he was wearing a jacket that belonged to the victim's husband. There was debate within the police department about whether or not to release the footage. In the end, the footage was released to the public, and for a while, the killings seemed to stop. Little did police know, Yu had moved on to targeting new victims with a new MO. His decision to target sex workers and masseuse parlors, knowing that their disappearances were likely to be reported or seriously investigated police, threw the investigation office off for a while. Sex work had always been illegal in South Korea, but until a few years before Yu began his attacks, police were known to allow brothels to function and even accept bribes from those that ran them. A new police chief changed this and cracked down on the red light district. This inadvertently created less communication between sex workers and police for fear of being arrested for their work. Finally, one parlor owner who had a number of his own sex workers go missing began to think something more sinister was happening beyond these women just running off. The final straw was when a man called the brothel asking for a woman to come to his home, but called from the phone number of one of the missing women. The parlor owner recognized the number and contacted police. After this call, police waited for him to call back and followed one of the workers to the location he asked her to come to. a park near Hanyang University. However, this woman was spared and came back to the police. He apparently told her to go because she was too tall. This was evidently common practice for Yu, who was looking for victims that were short and thin, making them easier to bury. Yu called the parlor back soon after and asked for a new woman to meet him in an alleyway. Police met him there and arrested him while he resisted, stopping him from committing another planned murder. At the time, they mostly didn't suspect him for all of the confirmed serial murders. All they knew was that he had some connection to the missing women from the brothel. Initially, they had no evidence or crime to arrest him for because he wasn't caught in the act of soliciting sex. But Yu violently resisted arrest and tried to dispose of possible evidence. He tried to chew up and swallow a paper flyer for the same massage parlor. Once arrested, Yu quickly admitted to the murders committed at the 4 publicly reported crime scenes. One officer tried to belittle him, saying he didn't look capable of the murder, and Yu was quick to correct him. He asked for a piece of paper and began to jot down tally marks. He returned the paper and said, "Sir, this is how many people I've killed." Yu then asked for the police to bring in his mother so he could formally confess to her as well. His mother and sister arrived at the station, and once he admitted, "I've killed a lot of people," his mother actually fainted. Yu agreed to verify his connection to police by going to the crime scenes and explaining what had happened. They began with a Gujidong crime scene. When Yu was asked to identify which house the murders happened in, he went to the house behind where the bodies were found and began to give facts inconsistent with the crime scene. Many officers began to think he was not the actual killer and stopped taking him seriously. Police brought him back to the investigation room at the station and began questioning him when Yu appeared to start having a seizure. Little did they know, this was something Yu had faked in previous arrests. Thinking the event was real, police removed his restraints. Yu then escaped by simply getting up and walking out during the commotion of the officers coming in and out of the room. Police found him in the red light district and were able to forcibly arrest him a second time, 12 hours after he was first arrested. Due to his confession during the previous arrest, they had more reason to hold and question him. During the second interrogation attempt, Yu said he would have continued on killing had he not been caught. He refused to speak directly to the forensic investigator who came to verify his statements, Kim Hee-suk, because she was a woman. Instead, Kim listened from outside the room. Yu went on to draw maps and details of the home invasions, talking his way through his murders in a supposedly boastful manner. He also confessed to killing dozens of women in the name of God and described the dismemberment and burial in horrifying detail. After his detailed confessions, Yu then distracted the investigators to the burial site behind a temple in the mountains. They discovered the dismembered bodies of the 11 murdered sex workers. The provided details in the victims' bodies were used to verify Yu's confessions and detain them. The day after his final arrest, Yu was captured by news crews wearing a raincoat and a mask to block out his face, and he was dubbed the Raincoat Killer. At one point, Yu directly stated his hateful motives to a TV camera and confessed his guilt for the crime, saying, "I hope this teaches women a lesson, that they shouldn't be sluts and the rich should know what they have done." Initially, police had no physical evidence to use in convicting Yu. When they first investigated his apartment, it looked spotless. Using luminol, however, a perfectly clean bathroom lit up to reveal bloodstains all over. This was how forensics decided to take a better look at the bathroom ceiling, where they were able to find 3 different traces of blood. Police also found an altered sledgehammer outside of Yu's apartment building. The handle had been shortened, making its swing radius uniquely short. Forensics lifted blood residue and DNA from the hammer, even though it had been cleaned deeply. The shape of the hammer also fit the particular wounds that police had struggled to identify earlier. The DNA lifted from the hammer was used to identify Yu as the killer in the cold case of An Jae-sun. An was a vendor whom Yu stabbed to death, cut off his hands, and burned his body in his own truck. Police struggled to identify the body before or collect incriminating evidence because of how badly burned and damaged his corpse was. Before the DNA testing, Yu was never suspected in this case, and its MO was much different from his other murders. On December 13, 2004, Yu was sentenced to death for being found guilty of 20 counts of murder. The District Court of Seoul made the following statement on Yu's conviction, quote, "Murders of as many as 20 people are unprecedented in the nation and a very serious crime. The death penalty is inevitable for Yu in the light of the enormous pains inflicted on the families concerned, and the entire society. Yu confessed to having killed 6 additional people and was initially charged with 1 additional murder. There was no physical or identifying evidence to follow up on the additional murder charge. South Korea has had a moratorium on death penalties since 1998, and Yu is still on death row today. Let me know your thoughts on the Raincoat Killer in the comment section below, and let me know what you think, or I should say, why you think he became a serial killer. And of course, if you want to support the channel, you can buy us a coffee by scanning that QR code that's right there. And anything you give goes right back into the channel. And of course, you can find us on all major podcast platforms, Google Podcasts, Apple, iTunes, Amazon, and Good Pods. And if you listen to us on Good Pods and Spotify, leave us a review. Let us know what you like, what you don't like. As always, thank you so much for watching and listening. We will see you next time.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.